يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Welcome to today's Middle East Analysis. Now, we've done a Middle East Analysis special, actually, on the papal visit to Lebanon, taking place between the 14th and the 16th of September. But what we want to do as well, as we normally do with our podcasts, is do a regional roundup and look at all the multitude of things going on in the Middle East North Africa region. Now, clearly, I can't do that on my own. You wouldn't want that either. So I am joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's consultant on the region, also an ecumenical expert, a lawyer, a political commentator and expert as well. Harry, you're very welcome. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure again, James.
So, where to start? The word, or the country, Syria, seems somewhat obvious. A lot in the press about a sort of post-Assad changeover, formulating what the roadmap might be without President Bashar al-Assad. Is that credible? I mean, certainly should be thought about, should it not?
It's interesting because you're absolutely right. There are two trends of thought in the region at the moment, James. On the one hand, there are people who are already thinking of a post-Assad Syria, and there are studies being done in Germany, there are studies being done in the States, which are imagining what a post-Assad Syria would look like. So in a sense, yes, there is a lot of that. And that, I think, is because of a feeling that his departure is inevitable. Now, we have in English the expression sooner or later. I would reverse that by saying later rather than sooner. I don't think he's going to leave tomorrow. I don't think he's going to go after tomorrow. But I think that things are pretty much building up to a crescendo where eventually Bashar al-Assad can no longer be president of Syria, because I think that even those people who are advocating dialogue and reconciliation as the way forward, who are bemoaning the violence that is taking place, and let us say the violence is horrendous, 25,000 people dead, some of the neighborhoods, towns, villages, even cities in Aleppo and elsewhere in Idlib, in Rastan, in Deir ez-Zor, in Daraa, you think you've come out of a war and you wonder what are those MiG-21 and MiG-23s doing up in the air? I mean, who are they fighting? Actually, they're fighting Syrians on the ground. So it's building up to a crescendo, and I think that even those people who say we have to resolve this through dialogue and reconciliation, we can no longer do it through violence or fighting, because the regime is still powerful enough to withstand the challenge. The Free Syrian Army and the opposition are still strong enough to maintain the pressure. So in a sense, we've created a bit of a standoff. Everybody knows that things have to change. Nobody knows how it's going to change. So whether it is by force or whether it is through dialogue and reconciliation around a table, I think the prerequisite for both is the departure of President Bashar al-Assad to facilitate the move of Syria forward.
Now, there's some interesting political rhetoric, though, isn't there? I find it quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to need your expertise, mm-hmm. so correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Hollande in France actually saying to the opposition, if you organise yourselves, you know, politically, mm-hmm. to give us a roadmap for post-Assad, we will recognise you and we will support you as the authority in Syria?
François Hollande is saying that the French are mavericks. I know France. I love France. I grew up in France. So in a sense, I can say whatever I want about France without blame. The French are very much mavericks in foreign policy issues. And I think they've been told off a little bit by the United States for actually saying it so bluntly. Get yourselves organized and we'll recognize you. But there is a tendency that the inevitability of a post Bashar al-Assad situation era is coming to the fore, and it is going to happen one day. So in a sense, I'm heartened, I'm encouraged that people are giving it some thought so that we don't end up in a vacuum like we did in Iraq, where suddenly a dictator, a totalitarian regime is removed, or some of its trappings at least are removed, and then we have a vacuum. And one of the laws of physics says that when you have a vacuum, everything gets sucked in and everything gets destroyed. So if we are actually in the process of seeing, as I know we are, a certain visions that would be put forward in order to lead lead Syria out, then that to me is very encouraging. But interestingly enough, your question, I think, requires, to be fair, two answers. One is this, which I think is the predominant thesis in the region. But the other one, if you hear President Assad's interview in Arabic to one of the pro-regime TV stations yesterday, he was basically saying, we are winning, we just need more time, and we will actually control the situation. My concern about that is, what is his definition of winning? How many more thousands of people have to die? How many more massacres have to be perpetrated? How many more villages have to be destroyed in order for him to be able to stay in power? This is why I'm talking not about a whole radical uprooting of everything in Syria. What I'm talking about is, in the face of the defections, in the face of the violence, in the face of the massacres, in the face of the hope of many, many Syrians, probably the majority, to try and resolve this one way or another and to come up with something that is not radical, extremist, and worrying, is for the president to move away either by persuasion or by coercion, so that eventually we can look forward and we can stop the massacres of Aleppo, Damascus, and elsewhere to continue on a daily basis, so much so that when you and I open the television channels these days for the news, or even if we follow our Twitter messages or Facebook, for instance, James, we are no longer shocked as we would have been 1 year ago by some of the atrocities that are happening in that wonderful country called Syria.
Now, I mean, are we going to be sitting here in another 12 months saying, oh, you know, Al-Assad's about to go, or what?
I hope not another 12 months, James. Might I remind you of something I often say, which I haven't said for a while, which is that I'm not a prophet and I cannot foresee the future. However, I hope it's not going to take another 12 months. I think it might well take until after the US presidential elections, but I'm not sure 12 months, because after 12 months, God help us, what will remain of Syria that is still standing up. But let me address one question very, very bluntly and very frankly with you. Yes, Pope Benedict XVI is visiting Lebanon, and part of his remit or the visit is to try and build bridges between Christians and Muslims. Part of the reason is that there is a fear within some of the smaller communities in Syria, including the Christian communities, that anything that will come later might be so Islamist in nature that it would actually curtail their freedoms and therefore be a problematic for them. So somehow, if I may use this term rather carefully, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. I very much disagree with that. If you talk to some Christians in the country who are immersed in the culture of the country, if you talk to a Christian Syrian like Michel Kilo, if you talk to Father Paolo Dell'Olio, who has been in the Deir Moussa monastery for 30 years and he knows Syria probably better than a lot of Syrians themselves, those people would tell you, no, what is happening is in some sense true. Change is always frightening. Change could also bring negative as well as positive developments. However, any Christian worth his or her salt should understand that when somebody is fighting for dignity, for freedom, to clothe the naked, to feed the hungry, to free the prisoner, what they are actually doing is paraphrasing the Sermon on the Mount. And in that sense, I believe that the Christians are very much part and parcel of the aspirations of all Syrian people to have freer country, a more democratic country, a country where they can celebrate their citizenship rather than hide behind certain small privileges that are given to the elite rather than to the whole country. So fears there are, concerns there are, but those shouldn't be impediments toward society in Syria and in the region moving forward toward a better future.
Now, whereas I appreciate that's a strong answer, one I like to hear, it still doesn't get away from the fact that the wider world makes the assumption that the Christian communities of Syria are pro-Assad. And that's somewhat frustrating, isn't it?
It is very frustrating. And the wider community and the tabloid headlines do that because, first of all, it's sensationalist and it attracts people's attention. Second, a lot of people don't have a deep enough understanding of Syria to appreciate that there are always nuances in such black and white situations. And thirdly, people who are saying this are actually doing a disservice rather than a service to the Christian or any other community in the region. I, for one, am quite well aware of the pitfalls that lie ahead. I, for one, am concerned about some of what might happen. Of course, I would be concerned if we end up in a post-Assad regime that is so Islamist in nature that the Christians would either be considered infidels or second-class citizens or dhimmi people, people, in other words, who have to be protected, whereas these are Christians who were in Syria and in the region before Islam ever came about because the Prophet Muhammad was not even around at that time. So in that sense, what I'm saying is let us be a bit brave, let us be a bit prophetic, let us try to look at the positive, at the ways of reconciling people together. Let us look at the example set by the likes of Father Paolo Dell'Olio and others, rather than looking at people who are saying, oh, it's going to be terrible afterwards. Because even if it's going to be terrible, and even if we forget all the other considerations that I've suggested to you at the moment, what I would say that it is politically foolhardy for the Christians, whether their hierarchy or their grassroots, to start fear-mongering and scaremongering, because at the end of the day, somebody is going to say, what did you say? What did you do? And it's going to be difficult defending a somehow indefensible position.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, change will at some point happen, and it's better to be ready for it rather than fearing it.
Absolutely. You see, you summed up 5 minutes of what I said in one sentence, James. That's why you are at that side of the mic and I'm on this side.
Well, staying on this side of the mic, I'm going to raise the second topic for this Middle East
which
analysis.
Which is what today?
It is the non-aligned nations meeting in Tehran, capital of Iran, obviously. Now, somewhat controversial, I think one could say. And we've talked about Egypt in particular. And the reason I bring up Egypt is that President Morsi is actually attending that and has been rather outspoken about the oppressive regime in Syria that we've been talking about. Help me get my head around this non-aligned nations. Number one, what is it? Why is it meeting in Tehran? And is it controversial or is it something that we should be looking at?
Well, it's quite controversial in a sense. The non-aligned movement is a movement that started in the 1950s, and some of its original formers were people like the Egyptian Gamal Abdel Nasser, Tito from Yugoslavia at that time, Gandhi, people in Indonesia, some other countries who put together this movement. And the idea of the non-aligned movement, James, was that at that time we had a world of two polarities. We had the Cold War, we had the East and the West. And these were people who said, we don't want to side with the East, we don't want to side with the West, so we form a non-aligned movement and we are part of that non-aligned movement in the middle. Of course, politically, it never works that way. It's a very nice cachet. It's a very nice term for it, non-aligned movement. But non-aligned movement is as aligned as any other openly aligned country. So within this non-aligned movement, there are people who bat for the West. There are people who bat for Russia. There are so many different people who have their own political proclivities, tendencies, and orientations. So in a sense, it's a misnomer or it's at best an anachronism. However, this one is happening, and the idea that the President Morsi of Egypt is in Tehran was in itself controversial. Should this man, who is the product of a revolution, who is part of the Muslim Brotherhood, should he actually go to Tehran? And one way of trying to polish the visit and to explain the visit, dare I say spin the visit, is to basically say that Egypt has been holding the chair of the non-aligned movement. Now it's Iran's turn. So in a sense, like they did with the Olympics and the Paralympics, and they passed the torch from London to Rio in Brazil a couple of weeks ago, the same thing is going to happen now in Tehran, where Egypt formally submits the chairmanship to Iran. But for me, the non-aligned movement, James, has two main focuses. in my opinion, those two are very Iran-centered. Iran wanted very much to have this movement in this conference in Iran, and it has really splashed out. I'm sure it's wonderful, and there are many people there. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, was there. That in itself was a controversy. But the idea behind it, for as far as I can see, for Iran is twofold. One, this is a golden opportunity for Iran to talk about its nuclear file, given the pressures that it is under from the West in terms of the sanctions. And let us not kid ourselves. Israel might sort of threaten that it wants to bomb Iran. I think that is deluded political nonsense. What is happening is that the sanctions are biting, and Israel cannot bomb the Iranian nuclear sites, because even if they do, they're not going to really achieve much. But what Iran wants to do is to promote its nuclear file. And the second thing it wants to do is to promote the Syria stroke regime reality, because Iran and Syria are very close, and Iran sees Syria as a beachhead to the whole Middle East and North Africa region. If you look at what is called the resistance rectangle in the Middle East and North Africa, it's Iran, Syria, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, and Hamas. Hamas has already left this rectangle. Hezbollah is having serious and, in my opinion, very responsible thoughts about how it should proceed forward. Now you have Syria and Iran. So Iran wants to make sure that its allies do not disappear in the region. So put Syria on one file, put the nuclear issue on the other file, and you would understand why Iran very much wants this non-aligned movement to happen and fought for it to happen, which it is. And would it achieve anything? In my opinion, not any more than what all previous non-aligned movement conferences have happened. It's an opportunity for people to get together, to talk, somehow to pontificate, to come up with very nice, lofty ideals. But at the end of the day, what matters in politics is interests. And interests are very clear in the region and across the world.
Now, I don't know if you can see in this slightly dimly lit studio, but I've got beads of sweat starting to cascade down my forehead.
Hot?
No, I'll tell you what it is. It's, it's that worrying time where I decide to hand over the floor to you, Harry, for a final thought.
Oh, yes,
don't be
I
too
know.
Controversial. Make my life easier, not more difficult. Go on, off
oh,
you go.
Oh, I know. You always worry about what I might come up with. And I've behaved, James.
You
must
have,
say that
you
I've
have.
Never actually come with anything too controversial. And I'm not going to do that today, but I'm going to be thinking out of the box a little bit. Let me tell you why. I'm going to refer our listeners to something that has, well, it has relevance in the Middle East and North Africa, but it's not happening in the Middle East and North Africa. It's the award of the Philosophy Adorno Prize that takes place in Frankfurt in Germany. And it's an annual prize given to a philosopher of weight of merit. And this year, the city of Frankfurt offered this Adorno Prize of Philosophy to the pro-Palestinian Jewish American philosopher Judith Butler. Now, that's quite a mouthful. Pro-Palestinian, but she's Jewish American philosopher Jewish Judith Butler. And the reason why it has created so much controversy, and that bit is controversial, is because she's known very much for her pro-Palestinian positions. She's advocated a boycott, the BDS, the famous boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israeli products, for instance, from the settlements, etc., etc. So many people in Germany and within Israel are very angry that she has been offered this prize. Anything that angers people, anything that gets people out of their boxes and their platitudes, I love it, James.
I tell you what, I didn't see that coming. Really, I didn't.
I did surprise you, and I hope it wasn't too controversial.
Not at all. It's
the event is controversial, but we aren't being controversial because we're just reporting an event.
Hey, it's there. It's a topic for discussion.
There you go.
And you brought it up. Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you ever so much for your insight today, as always. And I am going to give a few little tips of the hat here to your channels. Now we have epectarsis.net. Google it if you can't spell it. I struggle sometimes. And I'm Greek. But there we go. Also, you can check out catholicnews.org.uk, the home of the Middle East Analysis podcasts. And at Harry Hagopian for all of you Twitterers out there. Send a tweet to Harry.
As Harry tries to get his head round how Twitter works.
Yeah, he's getting there.
Well, you're a good teacher.
Let's hear from you. Let's hear from you. So, yes, you can be present with Harry on Twitter. Let him know what you think. Let him know your views on this podcast. And we will be back for another Middle East analysis, if I can prize Harry out of the region, because I know he's going fairly shortly, in the coming weeks.